The monumental tax overhaul of 2019 saw a swift demise at the start of the 2020 legislative session, but the issues that motivated reform are left unresolved. To give Utahns a better idea of what that means, Utah Foundation recently released Now What? A Citizen's Troubleshooting Guide to Tax Reform. The report addresses three basic issues at the center of reform efforts: the adequacy of general fund revenue, the competitiveness of income tax rates, and a large constitutional earmark. To take a deep dive into the issues, Utah Foundation research analyst Christopher Collard and I sat down with Utah State Auditor John Dougal. You'll hear that conversation on this edition of Utah Thrives, the Utah Foundation podcast. I'm Peter Reichardt. We're here with Utah State Auditor John Dougal to take a deeper dive into the issues addressed in our recent report. John, first, for our audience, tell us a little bit about the mission of the Office of the State Auditor.
I describe that our job is to be a constitutional watchdog to try and make sure taxpayer money is being spent legally, efficiently, and effectively, and help the citizens oversee their governments.
And turning to the issues around tax reform, the issues have generally been cast as a pinch on the general fund, with rising transportation and Medicaid costs. There are also concerns about the big constitutional earmark for education and a desire to cut income taxes. Now, you say, make sure I've got this right, that the underlying problem is a dying gas tax which impairs the transportation fund, and that if we don't fix that, there is no way of resolving our issues. So develop that thought.
Yeah, fundamentally, from my perspective, it's really a misdiagnosis last year when the legislature approached this. The fundamental concern from my perspective is the gas tax is dying. We have more fuel-efficient vehicles. People are driving more miles, but it's placing a bigger demand on the infrastructure. And you look at alternative fuel, I drive an electric vehicle, so I bypass the taxing mechanism when it comes to the gas tax. And so when you look forward, those trends are going to continue, and you can see downward pressure on the effectiveness of the gas tax to fund infrastructure. And when you look historically, the gas tax would pay most of it, some registration fees, other things like that. But when you look today, we have about $650 million coming out of the sales tax to prop up transportation. So we're paying more in sales tax for transportation than we're actually paying in gas tax, state gas tax, to fund that same infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. And now we're actually working this year on a study on vehicle miles traveled fees, but that funding mechanism is still somewhat in its infancy in this country.
And even though Eisenhower wanted the interstate system to be a system of toll roads, the gas tax was politically expedient in 1956, and people have had decades to get used to it, and it's hard to shift old habits.
Sure. And so I guess in your mind, if I may ask, what would be your short-term way of addressing that problem, or medium-term at least?
Okay, I'll describe. So in 2003, I actually ran a transportation planning task force bill. And what was our short-term solution was to use sales tax for a couple 2 to 3 decades to transition us as we look for that new funding source, you know, VMTs or congestion pricing or increased registration fees for cars, other things like that. It was to allow us a smooth transition as that gas tax continued to die to look for that new funding source. But it's been hard to actually move there, not just in Utah, but across the nation. But when you fundamentally look at what's going on with the general fund, it's being driven largely because of what's going on in the transportation fund.
How much does the earmark for education distort our budgeting process?
I would suggest it has not distorted it that much to this point. But if you have both public and higher ed completely in the income tax, the education fund, without higher ed straddling the line between the education fund and the general fund, then yes, it will start to throw lots of extra cash potentially into schools. And there's questions whether or not they can effectively use that. And then it could have the effect, if we don't solve the transportation piece, placing undue burden on the general fund to say, how do we fund, you know, health and human service activities, corrections, public safety, transportation, other things like that, you know, the various other services, because there's so much cash on the education fund or the income tax relative to the rest of the budget.
Sure. And this is something we've pointed out a number of times, that the earmark is in a way somewhat of an illusion as long as additional money is spent on education. But it seems to always be at the center of these budget discussions.
Well, education just in and of itself, because it's the top priority of the legislature to fund, that is always the focal point and the central part of the budget. And Everything largely is built around it.
Sure. How much do you think the discussions that we've been having are about income tax cuts as a priority?
I don't think there's been that much discussion. Clearly, the bill that the legislature has proposed has some in there, but I don't think there's been a lot of discussion about that. But you know, when we did tax reform the last time back in 2005, 6, and 7, ultimately passing the bill in 2007, the key rallying cry there was at 7%, our top rate was way too high compared to our peers. When we came in at 5, it at least put us in the ballpark with the others. We were still higher, but in the ballpark of everybody except for Idaho that was above us. And I think we need to always have that discussion to say, how do we get the income tax rate down, make sure we're competitive? Capital is more mobile, business is more mobile, people are more mobile than they've ever been.
Sure.
And capital goes to where it's rewarded, and it flees where it's punished.
Sure.
And we want to make sure it flows into Utah.
As I understand it, you also argue that there's potentially more fungibility around education than we generally think. Part of that is due to the availability of other higher education funds out there. Is that an accurate characterization?
Yes. So if I step back, first of all, I think the legislature didn't fully set up what their problem was that they were dealing with, and it kind of evolved over the last year. And so if the issue is just about flexibility in terms of budget, Senator Bramble had a proposal for a filing fee that had a refundable credit that would free up some money out of the income tax to go into the general fund. Clearly, there's lots of fees that are paid into higher education that you could use instead of just putting them in education. You could put that in the general fund and then send income tax over to pay for higher ed opportunities. So there is, if it's just budget flexibility, there are various tools or various gimmicks, depending on what one might use, to create greater flexibility in the budget when it comes to the general fund.
To what extent do we potentially run into a legal or political challenge with somebody saying, hey, get your hands out of the pockets of education, or making the argument that if we don't track things properly, then maybe we end up using tuition funds to pay for roads. What do you say to that perspective?
So some will always contend, hey, wait a second, that's all education, can only be used in that arena, and with some justification there. But historically, when you look at taxes and credits and other things like that, the legislature has created various opportunities and the courts have allowed various opportunities where it creates greater flexibility. Mm-hmm. And so if the issue is just budget flexibility, there are opportunities to provide that flexibility. If it's really other issues that are concerned, then we need to be clear what those problems are and figure out what solutions can tackle those problems.
So last week, the 4th District Court in Utah found that Pleasant Grove's transportation fee was illegal because it was more of a tax than an actual fee, because the revenues that were being brought in were using for general benefits instead of specific benefits. Do you think that would be a problem if the state started using fee revenue from higher education kind of in a general manner?
It depends on what they do and how they use it, but the legislature has more flexibility than a city does. Part of the challenge for Pleasant Grove City is they were outside the bounds of what the legislature had provided for them. And so that's part of the reasons why the court struck down that ordinance out there.
Mm-hmm. One of the things you've mentioned is that a lot of people are thinking about the issues wrong. If there's one kind of overarching correction that you would want the public or legislators or the media to take away, what would it be?
Well, I think from a legislative perspective, they need to determine to what extent do they have an income tax that has a rate that's too high that they're concerned with, mm-hmm. to what extent they have concerns with flexibility in the general fund, to what extent they have transportation funding challenges. You know, there's a whole slew of issues that are out there. They need to coalesce with a consistent message of, this is the problem that we're trying to fix, and here's why we think these are solutions. Fundamentally, as I look at really what's out there, it's the gas tax that's dying that is mm-hmm. really driving so much of this. And that's, I believe, if we can solve that long term, it fixes a whole lot of these other issues. Mm-hmm. But I will admit that is probably the hardest problem to fix in this whole discussion.
Sure. What about on the cost side? I mean, what would you be more worried about, Medicaid or transportation costs or something else?
Oh, from my perspective, as I talk with state auditors from around the nation, mm-hmm. Medicaid is an entitlement program mm-hmm. that you really can't control the costs. Mm-hmm. Versus education, public ed specifically, which we can control the costs. And the concern is when Medicaid collides with public ed, Medicaid will always win. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is a serious concern that Utahns need to be aware of. They voted recently to expand Medicaid, which is going to put a target on public ed mm-hmm. and put downward pressure on the ability of the legislature to fund public ed. And that is a major risk going forward.
Sure. And the other question that comes up is, what happens if we have an economic downturn? Does that throw more people onto Medicaid and drive costs up at the worst possible time? Or
Yes, so welfare programs are countercyclical. So as the economy turns down, more people demand it, the desire for government funding of those programs goes up mm-hmm. and stuff. And so that's just how that works. And that's why Utah works so hard to have rainy day funds set aside, other, you know, stabilization funds set aside to try and help mitigate those pressures in a downturn. But when you set aside 10% and you've got a multi-year downturn like we had in 2008, you know, that 10, 11% that you might have set aside nowhere near covers that
sure.
demand.
So we maybe need to be setting more money aside in these reserve and rainy day funds.
We need to look to say, how do we help stabilize some of the boom and bust type of dynamics? And mm-hmm. you know, rather than in a downturn when the public can least afford it and there's pressure to raise taxes, how do we help mitigate that in the good times?
Sure. One of the questions that's come up has been around the distribution of costs in education, that it appears that Utah is disproportionately using state funding for education versus local funding. Do you have any thoughts on whether that mix should be addressed in some way?
So one of the dynamics you have is, I know there's a push to say maybe we need to push more of the funding down to the local level, but you've got then the equity issue that comes into play.
Sure.
As just a simple example, you've got Park City that no matter what they do, they generate a lot of revenue off their property tax.
Right.
And Tintic, no matter what they do, they don't generate anything.
Right.
So you've got the wealthy districts, the very, very poor districts. So when you place more burdens on local funding, we run into those equity issues.
Just exacerbates an existing
problem. Makes it even
problem.
Worse. Right. And I hear some that say, well, if we push more local funding, it will improve the accountability at the local districts. But if right now you have 65-75% of the funding coming from the state, adding another percentage or two at the local level is not really going to increase accountability from mm-hmm. my perspective. Mm-hmm. And so I think we need to say maybe we need to step away from that. In fact, as you look at broader in terms of tax policies, I travel the state. First of all, I hear that we have a housing shortage. At the same time, I hear local governments say we lose money on homes. So they have a disincentive to zone for homes because the property tax does not fully cover the cost of police, fire, roads, and other services at the city level. Yet they love to zone for sales tax mm-hmm. because they get a windfall off of that. At the same time, we say, okay, we're going to raise the property tax on schools to improve accountability and other things like that. But it makes equity worse. And maybe when we talk the broader tax policy, we really need to step back and not just talk about state issues, state and local, and what is the appropriate mix of property tax, sales tax, and so forth
sure.
when it comes to local government.
So,
but that's really getting outside the box and really talking about these broader issues.
Sure. But it is an interesting question on with regard to the local, the incentives towards what kind of development you do. Just wondering how much the changing dynamic of how sales happen, where the point of sale is, from a store to basically somebody's house. Does that end up changing what kind of rooftops you're chasing, whether the shopping mall or residential?
I clearly it does. I mean, historically, you know, Walmart, Home Depot, so forth, they looked at the rooftops and plopped a big box store down where the rooftops were. Now when a lot more is coming through online sales, you've got Amazons of the world looking to say, where do we locate warehouses?
Sure.
It does kind of change that. I know some with online sales coming through, all of a sudden some communities that didn't really have sales tax, outlets or stores are saying that we're starting to see some revenue come in because of online sales that they haven't seen historically. But yeah, that creates a whole new set of dynamics going forward.
Different dynamic, right. Okay.
So one of the things you highlighted was kind of the eroding revenues coming from the motor fuels tax, how the gas tax was a dying tax. There have been some similar trends among the sales tax where the share of transactions that are taxable are decreasing in terms of the total economy. Do you see that as part of the problem as well?
Yeah, I was actually part of a sales and use tax work group back in 2008. We issued our report in 2009. Clearly, one of the challenges was the economy fell apart in the middle of our study. But we flagged what we thought was good tax policy, although difficult tax policy, is expanding the sales tax into final consumption of services. Of course, two-thirds of those services at the time was healthcare and housing, which makes it very difficult. But we do think that's ideal tax policy, but it's difficult tax policy, as clearly the legislature saw this last year. I think there are opportunities that you could have discussions and move somewhat down that path, but one of the challenges that the legislature encountered last year was they had done a 180-degree shift on what tax policy had been in the state. We had been moving more and more to take sales tax off of business inputs, and all of a sudden with their House Bill 441, we're proposing to place a bunch of taxes on business inputs and put the thumb on the scale in favor of vertical integration versus just being neutral on that. And so for that kind of significant shift, without a meaningful discussion of why we thought we needed to shift so much after decades of going down one path, I think caused a lot of folks concern. And when you look, as I mentioned, capital is more mobile. Okay, if the last thing that business wants and people want is tax uncertainty, I mean, if you have a bad tax policy, but it's certain, then you can figure out how to deal with it, cope with it, work around it, other things like that. But when you have tax uncertainty, then it causes people to not want to invest, not want to expand, other things like that, go to a different state. And that's where you want tax certainty in whatever you're doing, preferably good tax policy. And from my perspective, good tax policy is excluding business inputs from taxation and only taxing final consumption.
Going back to the fungibility issue, we've been here before. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so back in 2008, right before the economic downturn, clearly public ed and most of higher ed was being funded out of the income tax, and we were getting right up against that line. We had maybe $100 million of higher ed that was being funded out of the general fund. But then we had the economic downturn that essentially had the effect of resetting this fungibility question. So higher ed shifted back over into the general fund, the sales tax. And rather than using sales tax to keep paying for roads, we started bonding for roads and financing that. And that allowed us to continue to construct roads at the same time paying higher in public ed. One of the key things there is the legislature, while I talked about rainy day funds, effectively when we're paying ongoing money into one-time projects, that has the effect of being another working rainy day fund. Because when we hit that downturn, we can cut off that ongoing funding into transportation, finance those one-time projects, and free up that cash for other activities. And it's budgeting practices like that that have allowed Utah to be one of the best managed states in the nation, is to look ahead, understand ongoing money, understand one-time money, not put one-time money into ongoing activities. Has allowed us to be very prudent.
Can we talk about tax expenditures and incentives? We did a report in January, looking at the EdTIF program, and
you did a very good report.
Well, thank you. And a lot of that work hinged on the fact that you all had done a kind of a tough report on the EdTIF program. What was it, back in 2014 or 15?
Yeah, 2014, I think.
So a lot of what we covered was what has happened since then, and then of course we moved on to questions that are still out there. In your mind, with regard to EdTIF and maybe incentive programs more broadly, if you like, what are some things that you would still like to see improved or addressed?
So one of my broad concerns is clearly the tax incentive programs seem to go to favored companies and not broad-based to all companies that are engaging in similar activities. If you're more connected, you seem to be more in line to get the incentives than if you're a no-name company that's just trying to get off the ground. That's clearly one concern. The other concern is, while I may understand the purpose of them in an economic downturn or where there's challenges and you're trying to stimulate the economy, when you're still giving a lot of those out in a very strong economy where we're having challenges with growth and other things like that, it seems like it's an unnecessary stimulant in the economy that creates all sorts of other ramifications. And then when you have folks that are saying, wait a second, we're paying the taxes and they're getting all these benefits, how come our cost of doing business is higher and our competitors get this kind of incentive? I think it smacks of certain favoritism.
Now, one way of dealing with that would be to take the human element out of it, if I can use that phrase, or to not have a decision-making process per se, but just to have, if you check these boxes, you get the incentive. But then on the other hand, that would seem to exacerbate the other issue you brought up, which is that we're potentially pushing incentives out when we don't need to. So how do you kind of, what would be the balance between those two?
Well, even when you're checking the box, clearly somebody put in place, here's the criteria, here's the bias we built into the system. And so those check boxes have a certain bias built into them. If the issue is we don't think we can entice companies to locate or expand in Utah, then we really need to step back and say fundamentally, rather than these targeted giveaways, if you will, what is it that we need to do broad-based to make sure we have a strong economy that folks want to come here and want to locate? And if the other dynamic is every state's in this mutually assured destruction, we all have to offer these because they're offering, so we have to offer them. How do we go through some element of detente? I know Representative Roberts has a bill right now that basically says we're going to try and get into agreements with other states to all start stepping away from these kind of practices so we don't destroy each other's budget in the pursuit of trying to win something. And what happens too often, there's a concept called the winner's curse. And I don't know if you've heard this concept, but it means you're in a business negotiation and you win the negotiation, you acquire the company, but you paid too much in the deal and you actually lost as a result of that because you engaged in a poor deal because you're so emotionally connected to making sure the deal happens. And sometimes that's what happens in some of these incentive programs. We're competing with another state and we want to win. And so we actually results in a deal that is really bad for the citizens of Utah, bad for our economy at the expense of that negotiation, just because folks were emotionally connected to win.
Going back to your point of maybe we need to address fundamentals, does that then take us back to the income tax again? Or what would the fundamentals be? Because, you know, by a lot of measures, people would say, well, Utah is the model of economic development and growth, and we're doing great. And so what is there to fix?
So one of the fundamentals is clearly what is the tax burden, both on the business as well as on the citizens. So part of that's income tax. Part of that goes to sales tax. Are there taxes on business inputs or not? What are the sales tax burdens on the employees that work and live in the community? What is the burden when it comes to property tax? What is the regulatory burden that comes, you know, when you want to come here? How easy can you start a business? How easy can you expand? You know, all sorts of things like that. And I think Utah has a lot to offer. And while maybe 15, 20 years ago we had some issues, I think we're in a whole different position today and clearly need to step back and reconsider what is the purpose of these kind of programs.
Okay, so one of the things that was clear in the reform process that we've just been through is that a lot of energy went into it, but the public didn't come away with a clear sense of what the options were or why certain decisions were moving forward. I mean, are there better ways to communicate to the public about what the issues are and how we can address them?
Well, clearly, talking tax policy with the public is very, very challenging. It's a very complex issue, lots of emotional concerns that people have. But last time when we did tax reform, so this is 2005 through 2007, we put in place some very sophisticated models. And we could see each taxpayer on a scatter chart. And we could say, okay, modeling these kind of reforms, are they positively impacted, meaning did they get a tax cut? Are they negatively impacted, their taxes go up? If so, by how much? And we could model all sorts of different scenarios, not just that legislators wanted to see, but anybody in the public could come and say, well, what if we increase this credit? And what if we give a break here? And what if we eliminate this exemption over here? What happens? And we could let folks model it. And because we had modeled, I think it was thousands and thousands of scenarios, it created a feeling in the legislature that we've hit a sweet spot in that proposal, that we see basically the overwhelming majority of Utahns, we're talking over 90%, we're seeing a tax cut or no tax increase. Few Utahns were seeing a tax increase in that process. And so we kind of hit that sweet spot. But it took a lot of work for some smart folks to put in place their models, and then a confidence in saying, we want anybody to bring their ideas, and we're going to model it and see how it looks and try and find that good spot that we can get, if you will, consensus.
Kind of going back to transportation, you talked about how in the past we relied a lot more on user fees as opposed to sales tax revenues. In your mind, kind of like what's the ideal situation? Like what's the best way to fund our transportation infrastructure?
From my personal perspective, I think the best way to fund transportation infrastructure is user pay. So those that use, pay. The strength of our roads is built for the trucks, but the capacity of the roads is built for the commuters. And so I think I'm personally a fan. I've been a fan of congestion pricing for many decades, and this is where the price goes up as there's greater demand. And so those that are demanding that infrastructure pay a higher price, and those that don't place the same burden on it pay a lower price, and you really connect the usage of the road with those that pay for that road. And then if you start to fix that issue, now you start looking at how much we subsidize transit. And now you can have the fare box better match the users of transit with those paying for transit. Because now you've made it clearer, here's what it costs for this, and here's how you pay for it. When you subsidize it with various tax policies, then folks will typically want more than they're willing to pay for because they're hoping somebody else foots the bill. And we kind of hide the cost. And government likes to hide the cost to have you pay for something without fully understanding what the cost is behind that.
And so one question that comes up, like in our modern economy, we rely on goods being shipped to our store. We rely on Amazon delivering packages to our doorstep. And so much of that is dependent on a quality infrastructure of transportation. So is there a role for like general funds somehow paying for the general benefits that come from an infrastructure that allows that to happen in our modern economy?
I would suggest that when you have user fee, the users can be more incentivized to actually pay for the infrastructure they want. While there may be a role for some general taxes, I think what often happens is when it comes to general taxes, we underinvest in that infrastructure versus what the public expects. And we can see that oftentimes when we look at various buildings or various, you know, like public ed or higher ed or other programs where people wonder how come this is falling into disarray versus stuff that happens in the private sector where we can bring better efficiencies there and target the money at better meet the needs of the public.
That's a good point. We recently just did a survey and I was reading through responses about what the state needs to do better on, and a lot of it was infrastructure. It was a big comment, I think you read, about what the public expects versus what they actually get.
Well, you've heard the old expression, don't tax me, don't tax thee, tax the fellow behind the tree.
Right.
I mean, Frederick Bastiat, an economist from the 1850s, basically described government as striving to live at the expense of everyone else. And that's the challenge. But when it comes to a user fee, it's I'm willing to put my money to pay for that service at this level. And it's really easy to then target things to say, yeah, folks are willing to pay for that. We do it all the time in the private sector.
That was State Auditor John Dougal. And you could find the new Utah Foundation report, Now What? A Citizen's Tax Reform Troubleshooting Guide at www.utahfoundation.org.